Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victorian Division, I'm Lawrence Wade. I'm a member of the Council of the Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here on this glorious evening. Given the choices between wine bars and beaches and the Institute, I'm glad so many of you have voted to come here tonight for this interesting and important topic and subsequent debate. So I also want to acknowledge Lauren, who will be introducing our speakers more formally in a minute, but also I want to thank Access, which is the youth arm of the Institute, for arranging this and the other really terrific events that have been arranged this year. The level of energy and commitment and just raw spirit of volunteerism under the inspired leadership of Jason Singh and his team is just really remarkable, and I think a credit to the interest in international affairs and foreign affairs that we see expressed through Access. And the nature and calibre of the events that have been held this year, if it was a race between the Institute's events and Access's events, not that we see them as necessarily different, I think Access this year has given the Institute a good run for its money. So, speaking of recent events, the Institute held its signature annual event last year, which is the Sir Zelman Cowan Oration, at which the current Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade spoke, Dennis Richardson, and he gave a very cogent and good presentation at a very, I think, high-calibre event. And just before I hand over to Lauren to introduce our speakers for this evening, I just want to let you know that Dennis Richardson's predecessor at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Professor Michael Estrange, has agreed to address us in December at our Christmas lunch. So we'll bookend the year with another interesting perspective on international affairs from a former head of of DFAT. So on that note, I'll hand over to Lauren to introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Hello. Hi. Welcome, everybody. Really exciting topic, why women are key to a better world. I think it's a really exciting time that's actually not a question but a statement. And I think we are really lucky to have fabulous speakers here who are actually going to tell us how gender equality is central to development. Also why it's important to have projects that focus on women and increase women's participation in order to reduce poverty. So first I wanted to introduce Joanna Hayter. And Joanna is the Executive Director of the International Women's Development Agency, which is IWDA. And this is Australia's only development agency that focuses solely on women's rights and gender equality. Joanna brings 25 years' experience, which spans over 25 countries, and she's going to draw upon that experience to explain why empowering women economically, why increasing their access and control over resources, why reducing violence against women, and why lifting women's voices is actually going to lead to a better world. So please join me in welcoming Joanna.
Thanks, Lauren. Lauren is a very important part of my life. She's the executive assistant to the executive director, which is Lauren and Jo, at the International Women's Development Agency, and I'm deeply grateful for Lauren's insight and competence in terms of helping us to drive that organisation forward. Tonight's topic is great. This is my reason for being. It's my job, my life, and I believe the only answer to global survival. So we've been asked to address the question. Let me just find where I am. As Lauren said, maybe it's a statement rather a question. Women are the key to a better world. Well, it's an interesting premise, isn't it? And you know, there's a bit of evidence out there, if I can quote a few of those celebrity kind of famous people in the world. We see the Dalai Lama telling us in 2009 that the world will be saved by the Western woman. And he was relating to women's ability to generate and, in fact, statistically are generating small businesses that are increasing the workforce and employment opportunities for people at a faster rate than ever seen in history. We also have the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon telling us that he is deeply convinced. Now, this is Ban Ki-moon. Think of the cultural setting. Perhaps I try his voice. I met him recently. I am deeply convinced that in women, it's a slow, gentle voice, the world has at its disposal the most significant and yet largely untapped potential for development and peace. on in a slightly harder, faster and feistier mode, Hillary Clinton says, "We've seen again and again that women are entrepreneurial, accountable and practical, that they invest earnings directly in family and communities and pay back loans at a higher rate than the norm. Women are a good investment." So that's one view of it. Let me try to answer the question in a nutshell, and then I'm going to slow it down and take us on a bit of a journey. My view of this topic, women are the key to a better world, perhaps would be better expressed is that women's participation and inclusion are the key to a better world. And I think when we see the world in that way, we see a better world being defined as a world where the social changes that are needed to make a fairer and more balanced world are in place. And if we see the social changes that bring a more balanced world, read gender equality, read women's rights, then we start to see a world in which the roles and the capabilities and the experience and the knowledge and the aspirations of men and women count equally. And if we have that space, then we start to see decisions and resources being delivered to meet the needs and the goals of all people in our society, not just decisions and resources allocated based on a bias of decision making that reflects a particular culture which tends to be male dominated, and I won't go into patriarchy. That's not tonight's discussion. So that's what I believe is the significance about women being the key to a better world. Women's participation and inclusion is the key to a better world. It would help me, before I start to tell a story or two, to understand a little bit about who's in this room. So I wanted to just ask you, can we just sort of, with a show of hands and a bit of calling out, can anybody that is currently working in a development agency put up their hand? Thank you. Can anybody who is studying international relations, international development or akin put up their hand? Thank you. Or perhaps I should say teaching as well as studying. Does that change the numbers? Can anyone who has travelled to Timor-Leste put up their hand? Well, that's an interesting gender demographic. And can anyone who has ever stayed in a village in a developing country put up their hand? Ah, great. This is going to be fun. And a call-out question, please. Just a few examples. Can you tell me how much you earned as a weekly payment in the first job you ever had in life? Can I hear a couple of ideas about those figures? Doesn't matter how old you are. How much did you earn the first job you earned money for? How much was it?
$48.
How much? $60? Yep.
$48.
$52.
£500
a week was your first job. Wow. I'm not going to ask you how much you earn now.
In teaching?
No. Yes?
When I started off, I can't remember how much I got, but it was less than all the blokes. And even though I was stuck at the teachers' college,
yes,
the poorest students,
yes,
got more.
You were not valued equally. I understand. Can you tell me how much that was?
That was in the 50s.
Yes? And how much was that? Oh, okay. Anyone else?
I do know mine was the same as the Melbourne-Sydney airfare.
The same as the Melbourne-Sydney airfare. That's an interesting economy. That's an interesting economic comparison. Did it enable you to participate in life? So to earn a week's salary allowed you to travel to Sydney.
Effectively, yep. If anybody would earn more than a Melbourne-Sydney
chair. There you go. That's interesting. Mine was $7 a week. I was a schoolgirl, and I had the foulest job in the world, washing people's hair on a Saturday morning, but there you go. So about $40 seems to be the kind of starting point. That's interesting. I'm going to tell you a story about that in a minute. The story I want to tell you is about chickens. And I, about 14 days ago, came back from Timor-Leste, where I had been on a rural women's exchange. The exchange was actually a village exchange, and it was a part of IWDA's partnership in Timor-Leste, where we are seeking to empower women economically within rural settings through the establishment of Timor-Leste's first rural women's network. I think in the interest of time I won't give you the snapshot and the gender analysis of Timor-Leste, but I have that if that needs to come up in questions. In essence, Timor is a very young and newly independent nation, but still identifies as a very fragile state, it has to be said. It is a conservative society, reflecting the conservative dominance of Catholicism and all that Catholicism brings in terms of cultural norms and behaviours. And it is a country in which 85% of the population are rural and involved in agriculture. And that's probably enough as a snapshot. So this exchange, this is the story I wanted to tell, was about chickens, it turned out. It wasn't what I thought I was going to talk about. I thought we were going to talk about the economic future of Timor-Leste with a look, a deep look at the role that rural women play in Timor-Leste's economic future. The opening ceremony was a big event, a very important event, very, very formal event, in fact, and we were sitting in an open-air sort of thatched meeting space, which had seating for probably about the same size as us tonight, with a banner behind us that said in Tetum, the Rural Women's Exchange, and on the panel, speaking to the Rural Women's Exchange, were four men and myself. And all of the women involved in that jolly important rural women's exchange were sitting not in that space, but outside of that space on a different diagonal under a tree that kept dropping nuts on their head, and were separated because of their gender. And the whole reason we were there was because of those women. In the 3 hours of that opening ceremony, including the questions, which were elaborate and was active participation, I have to say, there was a lot of energy. In those 3 hours, 2.5 hours of that was spent listening to the men of various positions of authority, local government, United Nations missions, United Nations police, local security forces, various departmental representatives, business entrepreneurs, and so on and so on. They were addressing the issue of rural women, because that was the topic on the banner, the Rural Women's Exchange. And in that 2.5 hours, we heard about 30 guys tell us what women should do. They gave advice around setting up market stalls, and they gave the commitment to putting women onto the agenda at the next local government meeting discussing X, Y, and Z. And it went on like this for 2.5 of the 3 hours. I'm not kidding you. And the only person that was unsettled about that was me, to be honest, because I have a different perspective of this. My comment to everybody about that situation, no matter where it occurs or how it occurs, is that women are not an issue. We're not a project. We're not a program. We're not an activity. We're not a vulnerable, marginalised group. We're half the population of this planet. So you can't turn us into an activity or a program. And that is the essence of the challenge in addressing tonight's topic of a better world. The way that that then moved, so that's the sort of setting in which this began. That gives you a feeling for the cultural norms, the way in which women's interests, skills, capabilities, responsibilities and aspirations were dismissed. Then we moved into a space where we were lots and lots of little trucks over bumpy roads over many mountains. For anyone that knows Timor, you know just what I'm talking about. It's incredibly mountainous and incredibly bumpy. And as we sat in groupings in about 7 or 8 villages over the next few days, we started to discuss the economic basis upon which women felt they could improve their lives. Their goal around improving quality of life was to, in this case, increase income, which another way of putting it is to try and move out of poverty settings and to have greater choices and greater ability to participate in society, from the household to the community to the district to the nation. And so the discussion was amazing. We sat day after day after day, and I watched women discussing weaving techniques and the different stories that are woven into the ties. And we looked at 100 chicken ventures, and there was a sense of social enterprise about that that was very important. Very important. It was the first time that these women had met each other. The isolation factors in Timor are significant, both the physical layer of the country, but also the political and communications and so on. So it was brilliant to get people sitting together and exploring each other's cultures, exploring the roles that they played in economy in their communities in this case. But it was all very, very, very similar, despite quite different social factors and economic factors coming into play, which I shall talk about as the next stage. So my question to some of these women in terms of what had been happening on this journey, what had this kind of exchange and interaction brought? Where were you 1 year ago in terms of income as a woman? What were you able to earn? 1 year ago, zero. Zero. So working 16 hours a day, no income. Working 16 hours a day, no income. 1 year later, as a consequence of village exchange and some micro-enterprise development, we saw women just beginning to gain access to what were traditional markets, traditional economies of where women could participate, such as chickens, tofu, and weaving. Because that's what women do, isn't it? Isn't that what we do? We like those little activities, don't we? Now, the third part of this picture... Oh, sorry. So I didn't give you the economic measurement there. So in 1 year, from zero to about $5 a week. Now, the guy that was driving us in those rickety old trucks on the bumpy roads, he was earning $200 a week just to drive us. So the third part of this story is where we were when we were talking about chickens and weaving. And we were sitting in a district, mostly in a district called Swai. Has anybody been to Swai? Great. Yes? Great. Good. That's good. Swai is a fascinating place because, as you would know, Timor is extremely resource-rich when it comes to oil and gas. Swai is the place in which the most enormous infrastructure project is about to begin. Swai, at the moment, where these villages are, in which we were sitting and talking and thinking about economic empowerment, is a gentle coastline with almost no infrastructure, certainly no hospitality, very, very, minimal commercial economy, but the odd guest house, one market, a really great hospital, really minimal infrastructure. And the coastline has nothing on it. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, pristine coastline. Within probably a week forward, there will be the largest oil and gas project that we have in this region of the world, which will see, as we know, thousands of men arrive to do their jobs. And with those jobs will need to be the first phase of an oil and gas project in a new nation. The building, the infrastructure, the telecommunications, what comes with that, the need to eat, the need to play, the need to recreate, need to travel, need to build, need to buy, need to consume, all of that. Now, these groups of women have, and actually not just women, let me be fair, the population of Swai, there are very few people there that have ever had exposure to what the oil and gas industry looks like. Anyone that's grown up in WA knows what this looks like. Anyone that's grown up in Papua New Guinea knows what this looks like. Anyone that's grown up in Nigeria knows what this looks like. But the people of Timor do not know what this looks like. So we're sitting and talking about chickens and weaving and hoping that we move from $5 to $10 a week. And all around us is a world about to change. And my point about this is that at the time that this opportunity comes to this nation, which will be the sustainability factor for this nation, if we do not see equal participation and equal inclusion of women in this setting, the opportunity is lost forever. Women will continue to be relegated to traditional roles of how women earn income in rural settings. And yet, the only thing that stops that happening is the current decision-making processes. So what I see is a question of rights. And those rights include the civil and the political participation of men and women in all decisions to do with natural resource management and livelihoods and business enterprise. What I see is challenges to how the nation's economic empowerment will benefit men and women, boys and girls equally. What I see is very important issues around the safety and security of all people, but particularly the women, when that population demographic goes ballistic in terms of the numbers of men coming in, and doesn't take a fool to know what plays out when 5,000 single men fly in and fly out and don't have anything to do. We know what will happen to the women and the girls in that community, and the women and the girls need to be able to deal with that, both through rights and through resources and services. So these are really big questions. What I see in that space is not weaving and chickens. What I see in that space is the opportunity for anybody in that community that wants to set up enterprises that set up telecommunications, spare parts, merchandising, hospitality, tourism, you name it. It's all there. But the current structure is not going to enable that to happen. And it's likely that we will see a very poor expression of gender equality in terms of true access to that economy. So that's the story I wanted to tell. Because when we talk about women being the key to a better world, if we were to transpose equality, participation and inclusion of women into that picture, into that incredible opportunity in terms of nation building, and have an equal space in terms of how that land is managed, how those businesses are developed, who gets to own them, what happens to protection of land and resources and tradition and culture, who gets access to that, that will have a very different outlook depending on whether men and women or just men are the decision makers. And I just think that this is a really important case study in our world at the moment. And for anybody that has any connection, relationship or concern about East Timor, now is a really good time to be thinking about this paradigm in this nation's history. The essence is the key to a better world, or in this case, the key to a better, to a more sustainable society, in brackets Timor-Leste, will be that women equally make those decisions and are used for and involved with their capabilities, their knowledge, their skills, their inspiration and their learning. And I think that is the essence of what we're talking about tonight. My new T-shirt for IWDA is IWDA at the top. It's more than chickens. Thank you.
Thanks, Stu. I just wanted to introduce our second speaker for tonight. It's Minna Barling, and she's from Marie Stopes International. And Marie Stopes is a non-government, not-for-profit organisation that delivers family planning and reproductive health care to over 40 countries. And Minna has extensive experience, non-government and government experience, and she's going to draw upon that to explore how global policies impact maternal health outcomes. And she's going to use a case study from Cambodia to demonstrate how development partners and women navigate around policy trends. Thanks, Minna.
Hi. Thanks, Lauren. And thank you.
I'll comment to parts of that later. Try and weave it in. I'm here tonight, as Lauren said, to talk about how foreign policy has impacted on maternal health outcomes around the world. And I don't want to just paint a bleak picture, because foreign policy has markedly changed over the last few years, and we're starting to see a positive trend in terms of maternal health outcomes and poverty reduction efforts. But I do want to talk about the legacy that overly politicised foreign aid policy has had on women and broader development efforts. And I'll also talk directly to my experience working in Cambodia with Murray Stopes International. And as many of you would know, Cambodia is a post-conflict country and still recovering from years of civil war and genocide. I also want to frame this discussion in terms of Millennium Development Goal 5, which is to improve maternal health. And I come here today with my public health hat on, so I'm speaking from probably quite a technical experience, but I'm also interested in how health issues are politicised, and my work in reproductive health is a perfect case point for that. So I'll just give you some background first about the landscape, about sexual reproductive health and need. So every year globally, 215 million women want to use contraception but cannot access it. So this means that there's about 205 million unintended pregnancies each year, and many of these pregnancies end in an unsafe abortion. And this is a major cause of death and disability. We also know that every year about 220,000 children lose their mums because of unsafe abortion. So we've put women and children last, and we've squandered opportunities to improve maternal health. As such, maternal deaths remain a persistent public health challenge. And it's the poorest of women who die. So about 98% of all maternal deaths happen in the developing world. And this is about the equivalent of 3 jumbo jets crashing every day with all passengers killed. We have all of the technology and the knowledge that we need to stop this. So none of the responses are out of our understanding. And so I'll talk some more to that later. But my work is with Murray Stopes International, and we're a global reproductive and sexual health care provider. We work in 40 countries around the world, as Lauren said. And we're a unique organisation in that we're a social business, but we do have a not-for-profit imperative. So what this means is that our services in developed countries, like Australia, fund our activities in the developing world, in 40 of those countries. And some of our activities are also supported by bilateral and anonymous and individual donors. But last year alone, this support meant that we reached 7 million women and men wanting family planning services. So as an organisation, we're committed to completing the family planning revolution and eradicating unsafe abortion. So we're quite focused. But to do this, we need to rise above policy trends and fluctuations that sometimes deny the most vulnerable women essential healthcare services. We also recognise governments who are committed to using evidence-based approaches to reducing maternal deaths, and we work alongside them to do this. So it's actually worth mentioning now that presently Australia is actually showing a lot of leadership in this area, and we're actually seeing some quite exciting results, particularly across the region. Also the UK and US, they're significant donors for maternal health interventions, and they've made major improvements in policies. But what I'm going to be talking about tonight is probably more the legacy of past policy and how it's shaped service-seeking behaviour for women, and I'm going to use that case study of Cambodia. In terms of the policy I'm talking about, I go back as far as the Reagan administration, and this was the administration that politicised a key piece of policy, and it set forth an agenda that forever changed the face of what healthcare looked like. And one of the most infamous components of this is the Mexico City gag rule, which some of you here may be familiar with, which was adopted in 1984. So the crux of this policy was not to support any activities that gave advice, made available, or referred a client with an unwanted pregnancy to a safe abortion service. President Clinton rescinded this policy, Bush readopted it, and Obama has again rescinded, and these are the kind of games that play out. So further to this policy, there was also non-evidence-based technical directives by those more conservative governments, and it saw not just meddling in key policy issues, but it was more at the information level, so women at the village and community level, the kind of information they were receiving. And so this is sort of famously known, and many of you, I'm sure, it's called the ABCs, which is abstinence, be faithful, and use condoms. And so while the ABCs are kind of laughable for many healthcare providers, the thing that isn't is the dominance of this funding in family planning around the world. So ABCs have shaped a large part of what sort of information women receive. So with the gag rule, the Mexico City gag rule, which I spoke to before, which is the rule about not referring, providing or supporting safe abortion services, it was promoted by parties that both opposed abortion but also contraception. So what it ultimately did was restricted access to family planning and reproductive health services more broadly. And unfortunately, what providers were seeing in the field was an increase rather than a decrease in the number of abortions, and obviously because they limited access to contraception for women that wanted it. And here in Australia, it's probably a smaller part of the puzzle, but you'll probably remember the 1996 Telstra deal and the Harradine Amendment that came out of that. And those amendments, they further destabilised evidence-based population health efforts in the field. And I don't know if it's fortunate, but there was also a decrease in funding for family planning by about 85%. So it means that Australia wasn't particularly active anyway in those kind of development efforts. But what it did mean is that the bigger players with their own policy challenges and restrictions became even bigger. So they were, you know, the dominant provider. And I'll go to this later, but there's been some changes since this time. And there's also been organisations that have tracked policy decision making around maternal deaths. And so we see with poor policy, we can very clearly see spikes in maternal deaths. And again, likewise, when we have good policy, we can see reductions in maternal deaths. So none of it is rocket science. It's quite obvious. And so hopefully this sort of policy background starts to kind of illustrate some of the reasons why Millennium Development Goal 5, to improve maternal health, has been one of the most underperforming goals. So I'm going to talk to Cambodia because I've just come back there about 4 months ago, and I was with Murray Stokes there for 2.5 years, and so I know the country fairly well from a health perspective anyway. And interestingly, it's worth noting, this is a bit of an aside, but if anyone's been to Angkor Wat Temple in Cambodia, that's actually the site where there's the oldest image of an abortion known to humans. And it predates much further back than we thought was possible. It's from the 9th century, actually. And the procedure shown in Angkor Wat Temple is still the procedure that is done today in both Cambodia and across the region. And it's a technique called massage abortion. It's quite dangerous. But the reason this technique is still performed is, again, because of lack of access to family planning and safe services. It's not just the policy landscape that affects health services in Cambodia. It's also, as many of you would know, and I mentioned briefly earlier, the effect of civil war and genocide on the health system. So effectively it decimated the health system there. And another thing that happened during the genocide is the practice of targeting intellectuals, the intellectuals that were culled, I guess, meant that there were only 25 doctors left after the genocide. So that has huge impacts on your health system, which I don't even need to go into. But then you've also got damaged infrastructure, and then you've got erosion of supply chains for medicine. And if you think about Cambodia before this conflict, it was you know, there was a period of French colonisation that was quite well trained in terms of providers within the health system. So you end up effectively cutting off any supply chains, getting medicine in and out of hospitals and health centres and to the community. And then you have these again, these sort of emerging international policies that didn't consider how reproductive health should be integrated back into the health system as they were building it up. And reproductive health care is what's sort of known as the backbone of a health system, because the moment you start doing family planning, contraception, safe reproductive health services, you need to start training mid-level providers, you need infection quality control, you need a human rights-based approach, because it's all about voluntary family planning, and they're really important things to have in a country where you're trying to increase access to human rights. But we'll go past, I guess, the civil war and the genocide, and we'll look at up to 1991 and 95, when there was a UN peacekeeping mission, and the role of that mission was to restore peace and democracy, which is a pretty good goal. Unfortunately, the presence of male UN peacekeepers also coincided with a rapid spread of HIV and a flourishing sex industry, which is still there today. But the response to the HIV epidemic was a pretty great response, and they've managed to have some great results, and that's also been with the support of the UN. And what the peacekeeping mission did was that it had allowed the mechanisms and the place for funding to occur so they could start building their country again. And that takes us to about now-ish. And when I was posted in Cambodia with Murray Stopes, part of my role was to provide technical support to the clinics. And I'm not a clinician, so I'm more of a public health geek. So the level of support that I provide looks something like, I might look at a clinic and I think, who are the women using our clinics? Why are they coming in? What are the barriers to care? How can we increase access? And where do the services need to be? So how do we bring the services to the most vulnerable communities? And one of these assessments I conducted in our clinic, which is based in Battambang, and if any of you know Cambodia, that's sort of north in the northwest, and it's got a very sort of fraught history with because of the Khmer Rouge, many of the active members are from that area. But today it's largely peaceful, and it's a beautiful, beautiful part of the country, and it's very lush and green, and it's called the Rice Bowl. But some of the challenges in Battambang is that it is a point for trafficking for women and children, and mainly for the sex industry. And there's also, in other countries, but also within Battambang, the actual sex industry is really big. It's the second biggest sort of sex industry apart from Phnom Penh. And Joe mentioned before the issue around Timor, about what sort of things Timor are going to have to really start considering, and this goes to the heart of, I guess, of this issue. Anyway, so I'll go back to sort of doing this initial assessment in the Battambang clinic. So part of the thing that I like doing when I'm doing an assessment, and I don't get any of this joy anymore, but what I would do is quite often go through client records, and I'd be trying to draw out some themes and some sort of common ideas coming out of the client records. And as I was doing this in the Battambang clinic, I noticed that many of our clients were much younger than what we were seeing in our other clinics. We've got 7 clinics, and we work across probably 96% of the population. So I noticed they were much younger. They were primarily from the entertainment industry, and many of them were unmarried. And in the area that I work in, unmarried clients has really important data implications, because if you look at the global data that is collected around family planning need, it just collects data on married women. So it's very hard to grasp what the need is for women that are not married. And so one of the issues coming out with this cohort of women is I was starting to see a lot of them were coming in seeking medical care for incomplete abortions and other abortion-related complications. And so, you know, whilst in our clinic sex workers are just a small part of our demographic in who we see, we also we serve married women, farmers, garment factory workers. What's really interesting about this demographic is it's a really good way to very quickly demonstrate where the gaps are in your service system. So looking at your most marginalised population will tell you pretty quickly what's wrong with your system. I noticed a lot of these women, they were having multiple abortions, but they were reporting really high rates of condom use. And I could see they weren't being counselled in other contraceptive options, even though repeated pregnancies was clearly an issue. So I spoke to our nurses, and the profile that I'd created had exactly sort of matched the issues that they were dealing with. And what they were saying were the sex workers were coming in, they would have gone and had a service in the informal market, an abortion service, and so this is why they were presenting then with complications from that. And when I say the informal market, I mean in Cambodia, every marketplace, there's abortion pills smuggled in, mainly from China, and some of them the quality is fine, but often it's not fine, and so you have some complications related to that. But there's also, again, the issue with traditional providers doing services with inadequate training and equipment. So we go back to that image in Angkor Wat. And we also have public health providers working in government, the government system, which have they're on about $40 a month. So of course they need to supplement their meagre incomes with this kind of work that they often set up a small business in their home. So after sort of collating this information, some of my immediate questions were, why weren't they using adequate contraception to protect against pregnancy? Why were they accessing unsafe abortion when in Cambodia it has a very progressive law? Abortion is available on demand and safe abortion services were available in Battambang. And how could we intervene in the existing informal system in a way that would improve their health outcomes? So with these questions in mind, I met with a number of organisations who are very well respected and have very good connections with this group of women in Battambang. And I came away with some really weird, quite disturbing findings. And most of the problems that had been identified were shaped by the foreign policies that I mentioned earlier. So some of the findings were, none of the organisations knew that safe abortion was legally available on demand. So there'd been this very discreet culture of referring out to people that they knew. And this practice was and is firmly entrenched. And so this shapes the way that we deliver healthcare forevermore now. You probably won't be able to disentangle the informal system. And this also matches the research. We know that about 80% of women seeking abortion in Cambodia do think it is illegal. We also found numerous examples of women going into the public sector and just being referred out to that private provider's home. There was also quite massive confusion about the 100% condom compliance targets, which are a foreign policy objective. And there was lack of awareness about dual contraception. So those of us that work in this sector know condoms are excellent at HIV protection. You should have 100% condom use, but it's not so good at preventing unintended pregnancies. So if there is that situation, you should also be using another method. So there was also, within the people I spoke to, there was a culture of fear and a bit of panic around funding loss. And so this had sort of resulted in a culture of over-reporting about condom use, and it had reduced access to emergency contraception and reproductive health services. And the main concern for me is that we've then lost our grasp on the data, which is quite worrying. There was also a lot of misinformation around emergency contraception, which can be taken after 5 days after unprotected sex. And it's actually available free throughout Cambodia, thanks for the UN. So I also did a review of the available literature. And so the review confirmed what we knew, that women were extremely vulnerable to unwanted pregnancy, and that we found that about 31% of women in Cambodia had had an abortion in the last year, which is quite high. And we also know that there is underreporting. About 97% of sex workers were reporting condom use with their clients, which is very good, but it drops down to about 63% with sweethearts or their boyfriends. But in addition, and this is something we really hadn't considered, the rape of sex workers it's endemic, and 90% of sex workers have been raped in the last year. And most of the violence is gang rape. It's a practice called bulk. The cultural term is bulk. But for those 90% of sex workers that are gang raped in the last year, about half of perpetrators won't wear a condom. So in terms of thinking about your health planning, policy impact on what you can and can't deliver, this becomes a bit of an untenable environment. So as a public health person, it's about being incredibly pragmatic. But then to further compound this challenge, there was also policy sanctions, which had a very earnest and very good worthwhile goal to reduce trafficking. But what it had seen was that the formal sex industry had become dismantled. And this is exactly what we're seeing in Battambang. So once we had a very formalised sex work sector, and from where our clinic is in Battambang, you've got like a strip of entertainment venues that are just packed and they're pumping. And from a public health perspective, that's very good because you can go into that place and you can do some really good public health work. But with the policy changes around trafficking women, the practice became much more street-based. And from a public health perspective, that's really, really bad because it's really hard to see where people are. It's very hidden and you have a lot of problems. But it's not just that, it's that the policy directives also saw the formal healthcare system services happening out of that. So it wasn't just that sex workers had also gone out of licensed venues and entertainment venues, but the healthcare system is also becomes very informal. So this impacted significantly on unsafe practice and poor health outcomes and maternal deaths. And I'll go quick because we're running out of time. But because the suppliers were disrupted, the providers in the field were saying that these policies undermined its own foreign policy goals. And so that's why we saw the increased risk. But since this time, there is good news, and as most of you, I'm sure, know, that the USAID Mexico City policy was rescinded under Obama. And so what it now means is while you can't use USAID policy to support abortion, you can now talk about it, you can now refer to it, and so that information is trickling to the village level. And at the same time, the Australian government moved towards a rights-based, evidence-based approach for family planning. And the UK has shown, UK is probably showing the most significant leadership in this area. So we're now seeing, again, successes and wins in terms of maternal health improvements, and we can again track. And so it's quite an exciting time working in this area now because it's really positive and there's really good things happening, and you're seeing marked improvement in maternal health outcomes and reduced deaths. So what do we know about what works? We know that access to family planning and safe reproductive health services will prevent up to 70% of all maternal deaths, and safe delivery and postnatal care is also essential. We're getting a greater understanding of the legacy of policy on maternal health outcomes, and it reminds us of the challenges set for us in scaling up access to voluntary family planning and safe reproductive health services. So I guess in closing, why is it important to developing it to a better world? Because I've largely ignored whatever I was supposed to do like I normally do. It's because with this new agenda and with the new shift, we'll see very much significant reduction in maternal deaths, and our contribution to Millennium Development Goal 5 is looking much better. And what Millennium Development Goal 5 and reducing maternal deaths does is it helps us with all the other Millennium Development Goals. You can't do it without 5. So what it means is that if you can just let women control the family size to what they want, and if you can reduce maternal deaths, you'll realise your human rights, you'll alleviate poverty, you'll save lives, you'll empower women, and you'll ensure that your development efforts are sustainable. Thanks.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much. We've got 22 minutes for questions, and in asking questions, would I just ask you to give us your name as you ask the question, and whether your question is directed to one or both of our speakers this evening. Any questions?
Michael Holden, council member. The question is to Joanna. Joanna, you're very committed in what you do, and I think one, without any disrespect, could use the word pretty bolshy about it, and I use that in a positive sense. Have you found that that's led to any resentment, conflict with what I know in PNG are called the big men of society? I spent a bit of time in PNG, the big men rule the society. They don't like being told what to do, particularly by Westerners. And I'm just wondering, how have you found that? Have you found it?
Oh, look, I live for those moments, don't I? Isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting? I'm seen as bolshy. The other word that I get all the time is I'm passionate. I'm passionate.
They mean the same thing.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting because when I'm in a debate or any other situation where my male counterpart speaks with vigour and determination and courage and conviction, they're called movers and shakers. So you can feel where I'm coming from. I don't hide my feminist background. I don't hide my experience in this world, which has not always been one of the privileged white women with a good education. I've lived in war zones for 15 years of my life. I've worked in refugee camps in Africa. I've been raped. I've been abused. And although at this point in my life I look like a pretty standard middle-class white Western woman who's a bit of a bolshy feminist. And there's a reason why I'm a bolshy feminist, and there's a reason why I choose to lead the International Women's Development Agency. Because until this world reflects and respects the population of this world equally, we will not see sustainable outcomes. We will not see those statistics change. We will not see climate change, economic parity, equal pay for equal work. We will not see the right proportional representation in our governments, in our businesses, in our companies, which will bring a whole of society approach to making decisions about our future that are sustainable, not representing a vested interest. So yes, I feel stroppy about this. But if you were in my shoes, you would feel stroppy about it too, I suspect. The interesting thing about where we find ourselves in this gender space, and I say this because it's a nice, closed, friendly room, and I'm actually a very friendly person deep down inside, is that it's very difficult to imagine discrimination, marginalisation and exclusion if you've never experienced it and if your life doesn't bring you that situation. And I mean for those of us in this room right now, not the image of poverty and development and fragile states, but in this room right now. If you haven't walked in those shoes, you don't know what it is about. And so, you know, I just, there's nothing new about what I'm saying. It's just that the challenge continues.
Do you have a lot of conflict with the big men?
I believe it or not, I'm quite diplomatic in the international relations setting. This is my home and my culture, so I'm not afraid to speak freely. It is my right to speak freely. I tend to frame the challenge. You are unlikely to hear me talking about human rights when I was living in Burma, but I do talk about leadership. And I do talk about capacity development, and I do talk about organisational development and institutional change. And I take a policy approach to that, and I tend to draw on what are international conventions, the global human rights conventions, and various other legal frameworks to which all of these nations are signatories. That tends to be how I do it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Again, my question is to Joanna. To force speakers, thank you very much for hearing your name. It's just amazing what I've heard tonight. Joanna, the pictures that you have painted for us from Timor-Leste are really quite confronting and quite bleak. At the same time, the aspirations are there. But a lot of it has something to do with a lot of it seems to also require quite a bit of legal framework around it for anything from outside to be done. So how do you see that happening? Because, I mean, all these people are sitting here, the best scenario is probably somebody from Foreign Affairs being able to some lunch to something or stop somewhere, but something that needs to be done inside that particular country through its own legal framework. It's a lot of it is legal question, whether it's local or national level. So
thank you. Joanna.
Yeah, and Mina, you can answer this one too. I know you can. It's really it is legal, but it's the cultural premise of our societies that includes legal frameworks, economic frameworks, religious frameworks. It's those structures and mechanisms that bring us that challenge in terms of gender equality and being able to find a place where women's participation and inclusion enables a better world. Yeah. So I understand what you're saying. How do we do that? Good question. In the case of Timor and the Rural Women's Network that we're describing, the approach there is an approach that reflects international relations and an approach that reflects development partnerships, in this case between women's organisations, but can be partnerships of many different descriptors. And those partnerships are based on, in the first place, what we were doing was bringing people together that hadn't been able to meet, exchange their stories and experience before. There was a sense of isolation that tends to keep things the way they always were, rather than enable people to think about the future as it might be. And so bringing people into dialogue, into spaces that they wouldn't normally have access to, is an incredibly empowering thing to occur. Sustaining that communication and dialogue is equally as important. One-off doesn't get us anywhere. It's about planning and management and leadership and problem-solving and strategizing. Yeah? So in this case, the objective is economic. We need to find new ways to bring what is full economic participation to the women of Timor. The opportunity is the natural resources in front and the business enterprises that come with such a huge infrastructure project and program over many years, over many generations probably. And so that's the approach. You start where people are most comfiest talking, in this case through village exchanges, in this case with a distinction between men and women. So bring women together, bring men together, don't put everybody in the same room at the same time. The culture does not allow equal voice in those situations, and move that forward incrementally over time through years, bringing those groups and those ideas up into structures and mechanisms that allow wider decision making or wider analysis around the kinds of business enterprise that's possible, and diversity of thinking. Wouldn't that be interesting? And that's the process. I mean, I could talk about that for a lot, but it's a wonderful expression. It will never ever lose its significance. Think global, act local. It is highly appropriate as a mindset in looking at this, and the global in this case are the rights of all people to XYZ, and the local in this case is the mechanisms that we choose to either use or change that will bring that access. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Mina, do you want to add?
I'll say something quickly. And I apologise, I'm going to speak to the stuff that I know about because it's probably the most useful. But Timor is interesting because there isn't adequate legislation there at the moment around reproductive health care. And so what we know if we look globally is you'll see similar rates of abortion across the globe. But what you'll see is you can actually track the deaths to how progressive the law is. So where you've got quite progressive, good public health legislation, you'll see a reduction in deaths. Where you don't, you'll see the same amount of abortions, it's just more deaths. And I just saw Sasha over there, who's at the moment working on a piece for me, tracking different legislation. Very important work. But another thing I did want to say is, and this isn't about reproductive health care actually, this is more about some legislation that I have worked on in relation to domestic violence and rape and sexual assault in Australia, is absolutely you need very good legislation. But it really, and this is personal, this is like not me speaking on behalf of the organisation, but it does bother me when, for example, when I was in Cambodia and there was some law reform happening around rape and sexual assault, which was very important, but why would you bring over law reform, say, from the legislation from Australia, especially in relation to rape and sexual assault, when it's a bit of a failure here? And so if you look at all the sexual violence that happens and maybe 1% of those cases go to court and then it's something stupid like 0.05% result in a conviction, why would you bring that into a developing setting? So I think you have to proceed with caution as well.
Thank you, sir.
My name's David Price. I should declare myself. I'm a retired medico. I've been to Timor to work 10 times in the last 10 years. I go with the friendship groups. particularly one that's based in Los Palos, which is about as far east as you can go and as poor as you can get. And I was delighted to hear your interest and your passion. There seems to be a question that might bring the two of you together. I don't think you mentioned this. The empowerment of women in family planning in East Timor, in the context, as you mentioned, of a very conservative Catholic population. Mm-hmm. I'd actually, 5 years ago, raided my niece's work at Ansell. She was actually a sex union worker, and she managed to get me 10,000 condoms. And somehow I got them through the airports of the world, took them to Los Palos. I gave about six away to six young men on a truck, and gave the rest to the doctor who was working in Los Palos. And I went back a year later, and they were still stuck in his cupboard, because nobody is empowered. The women are not empowered enough to make their men use them. Now, what can you do with your passion to change the Catholic view and
there you go. 10 minutes on. Mina, please.
Did you give them to a male doctor?
Yeah, he's the only one in the
yeah.
town.
And so I guess if you look at the patients, and this is kind of what we've learnt in many of the countries we work in, we still struggle with it, but when one of the challenges to services we find is if you're working at the doctor level, especially for something like condoms, which anyone can distribute, they never get out. They end up bulging in cupboards and past their expiry date and whatever. And a big part of the work, and this doesn't answer the Catholic question, but a big part of the work that we do is around what we call task shifting and paramedicalisation, and that's really about empowering often female, but not always, more mid-level health providers and community agents to provide those kinds of services, because doctors are too busy. They're managers. They're not, you know, we've just found that that's been a really good response.
Yeah. Thank you. Back to the question.
Yep.
You didn't answer.
Yeah, the Catholic one.
The Catholic one, because in fact that doctor left was replaced by a dozen Cubans.
Yep.
Half of which are female, and the medical service in Timor now is still run by Cubans.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they still have this problem that the bishops won't let them advocate condoms.
Put the condoms in the community and out of the clinic. I have to be honest, we have clinics in Timor and we do provide services there, and I guess it's around how you shape a service so that people are empowered to go to it.
But you're defying the conservative culture.
I'm going to just come and join Mina up here at the moment rather than make it look like a state of the nation. Yeah. Let's just talk together. I think that, you know, that it's a really good thing to unpack. Those kinds of questions are the key to a better world. We know they're the questions. So religion, regardless of which religion, is a mechanism and a structure formulated through history, through the leadership and vested interest and power of men. Find me one that isn't, and I'm happy to talk about it. But yes, that's
a suggestion for trial Buddhism, because in Bangkok, cabbages are condoms.
Look,
condoms should be as
yeah. Yes and no. Look, in principle and theory, I understand Buddhism. I lived in Myanmar for many years and learned a great deal about the Buddhist aesthetic and Buddhist approach, and I have to say it's just as rife with sexism as a structure as any other religion, although generally speaking the Dalai Lama is probably a fairly impressive leader in this world. But this is the challenge, and I think it's a case of, in all directions, the dialogue must occur. That at the community level, it's very, very difficult to challenge those structures and mechanisms. But as I said before, all of these nations, signatories to the kinds of conventions that make discrimination, that make XYZ illegal. And there has to be, somewhere through the convention to policy, to the dialogue at, in terms of those that are responsible for the implementation of those conventions, there has to be a challenge at that level. And it's not good enough for us from the West to say, when we engage in development programs, we have to respect the local culture. We have to respect the traditional culture, because to do otherwise is to be a Western imposer or a neo-colonialist. Well, I'm sorry, if those traditional cultures are treating women and girls in the ways that we've started to unpack tonight, it is not an appropriate culture, because it does not protect the rights of all.
I'll just say one more thing, sorry. I think it matters less about those religious issues than we think it does. And I know that they're very, you know, it's important. But the fact is, I mean, especially in a Catholic country, what you'll find is lack of access to family planning, so you'll have a service need, and women will walk over hot coals, as you would know, to get a service. Some of our biggest programs are in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which are very, very old school Islamic societies, and I will tell you that does not, having a religious whatever ideal imposed on a society does not make an iota of difference to sexual practice and what the services are. So I think it matters less than we think, and if we get less bogged down in those issues and more about how we can get the services working and a little less attention on that, I think we can achieve more.
Economic decisions around better service delivery.
Yes.
Okay, we've probably got time for two more questions. Do you have your hand in your hand? Yes, you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ghazi and I edit Monthly Access. My question's for Minna. I'm curious about the old euphemism of refusal to accept evidence-based policy. I was wondering what you actually meant by that and why it hasn't been convincing for people, particularly in Western countries where that evidence-based policy paradigm is pretty embedded in public services.
I think if we look at what evidence-based policy might look like for reproductive health, which is access to all of the available contraceptive options, and that includes medium and long-term ones, especially for women with large families that don't want any more children, and it also includes safe abortion and post-abortion care for women that have had unsafe abortions, it goes to the heart of a lot of discomfort that policymakers and politicians might have about what it means. So I think what I find fascinating about the area that I work in is it's probably the most politicised area of health. So even though evidence-based practice or policy, it sounds very simple, it just gets steeped in those kind of issues about, you know, the fact is women don't want to get pregnant, they may want to interrupt that pregnancy. People find that, for whatever reason, quite offensive and challenging. I don't know, does that answer your question?
I'm mostly curious as to what you see as the objective, because evidence-based policy is you're trying to meet the best way to meet some objective.
Yeah.
You actually see as the end goal.
Yeah.
of the area of work that you're doing.
So the end goal is to reduce maternal death and improve maternal health. So what we want, so we've got all the evidence. We know what works to do that. It's just scale, which is possible. So we just want the policy to look like that. But in saying that, it depends. Like there are parts of policy that's developed by government that I would always be far more pragmatic and not expect. So one of those areas is around providing safe abortion in countries where abortion is illegal. Now, I would be silly to think that I could actually do some kind of change in governments to say that they'll commit to safe abortion in the country where it's illegal. The best a government will do is safe reproductive health services according to the national law, and then you need other donors who are prepared to take those bigger risks.
Sorry, what that is like? Is anyone actually, like, denying that that is a goal? Like, maternity?
No one denies that.
Exactly. So what are they doing?
But that's not the issue. They disagree. It's a very good space at the moment, but historically the disagreements have been on wanting to either not have a pregnancy or interrupt a pregnancy. That's where the disagreement lies. And if you look at the religious influence on politics, I don't need to tell you. There it is.
Thank you. We've got time for one more final question before I hand over to Lauren for a vote of thanks. And I would also ask that before you leave, Lauren, hand to most of you as you came in this evening a questionnaire. If you haven't already done so, could I ask you to complete and return that questionnaire? All feedback is extremely useful for us as we navigate the development of future events. Could I ask the final question? Yes, ma'am.
Hey, My name's Caroline. A question for both of you. I've had times when talking to people in my network or community, there's quite a barrier to people having conversations about gender equality. Things to say something like gender or feminism in terms of switch off. So I wonder if you had any tips on good ways to communicate that and get the message out about the importance of gender equality.
www.iwda.org.au. One. Good. Search feminism on the web. Look at what it means, how it's got a history and so on. Find new ways to talk about fairness, equal share, equal voice in a way that doesn't come across as bullshit and too passionate.
I might take a different tact, I think. I just do whatever it takes to communicate. So I was looking at some interesting notes the other day from a meeting of treasurers from different countries and how they talk about family planning. So I'll cheerfully use that language. I guess it's really about what we want to see at the end of the day. But I think in terms of working in this gender space, and there is people cringe about this stuff and they find it uncomfortable and whatever, we do have to reduce that, and especially for younger people coming through. I also think, and there are many blokes here tonight, and that's super fantastic, we have to get better at working together, because I think ultimately we want the same thing, but I think sometimes we get caught up in language and things like that. I think we need to rise above that.
That's brilliant. On behalf of the Institute and Access, could I invite Lauren to give a vote of thanks to our two speakers this evening? Thank you, Lauren.
So thank you, Minna and Joe. It's been a fascinating night for all of us, and I know this is one of 100 things that you guys have done today, so thank you so much. And on behalf of Access and the Australian Institute of International Affairs, we just want to give you a little something to say thank you.